Welcome to Project Chatter, the podcast where PPM experts from various sectors talk about the latest trends. Listen to Val and Dale as they talk about tried and tested best practices and share their unfiltered thoughts about the industry. Whether you're here to learn how to progress your career, improve your project control skills, or just want to hear an Aussie and South African rant about projects, then you've come to the right place. Welcome to the Project Chatter podcast with your hosts, Dale Fung and Val Matthews.
In today's economic climate, construction cost and schedule overruns can be disastrous.
Innate construction software helps you spot risks before they happen.
Their cloud-based solutions give you the real-time insights you need to minimize risk and improve operational efficiency.
With Innate, you keep projects on schedule and under budget. Get started today at innate.com. That's INEIGHT.com.
In this week's pod, we were rejoined by Jonathan Norman and Donnie McNichol, or Johnny and Donnie, to discuss the new project manager. Jonathan Norman was a business publisher for 26 years, specializing in topics including project and program management. Following 6 years as knowledge manager at the major project association, he now works freelance. Awesome. As project strategy and knowledge consultant, specializing in communities of practice, as a freelance development editor for business book authors.
Donnie McNichol is the founder of Team Animation, which works across multiple sectors, energizing leaders and teams, delivering complex change to maximize value and certainty of success through a focus on the human dimension. Donnie acts as a catalyst to support organizations to improve their collaboration and productivity, aspects that will be critical to tackling many challenges we face today, including climate change, and in particular, in meeting the net zero target. Well, Val Martin, it was a fascinating discussion with both Jono and Donnie. I don't think we've actually had a discussion on human-centric data before, but it's a really interesting experiment that they're going down, and I think a lot of the listeners will find it quite intriguing and perhaps do their own testing and experimenting within their own teams. But Martin, if I come to you first, what were some of the key takeaways that you took from it?
Yeah, a lot of it for me was just going back to basics. Projects are delivered by humans, ultimately. We've talked a lot about AI on previous episodes, but having some of this data beneath it, Jonathan made a good analogy during it, almost showing the shadow organization within the real project. If you have that human data beneath some of the performance data that we're used to seeing, it will give you a real perspective on how things are doing. Val, how about you? What were your main takeaways?
Well, I disagree with you, Martin. I think it was absolute rubbish. No, I'm just joking. It was fantastic. I mean, we love these two gentlemen. They're very seasoned professionals. They're well known in the community. And the fact that they're adopting this data-led approach for humanistic behaviors and how that plays into project success is really interesting. We actually went over time, so it would have been great to have maybe a part two, but we really enjoyed the conversation.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And folks, there you heard Val's sentiment analysis there. He's talking just after Australia lost to England in the Women's World Cup semi-final. So, yeah, we talk about sentiment analysis as well in this one and how that plays a part. But we won't spoil it all for you. We'll leave it there. As we say, keep listening, keep liking, and keep paying it forward. Yeah.
Hello, project people. Welcome back to a brand new episode of the Project Chatter podcast. It's always good to have you with us, and it is good to have a full house. Dale, Martin, how are you, Dale?
Yeah, I'm good. Thank you, Val. It's good to have you back on the podcast. We were looking for you, searching for you. We couldn't find you, but you're back.
Yeah, I had things to do, mate, but it's always good to hear some of the podcast without me. It was a bit bland, but the guest was fantastic. So shout out to Joe Little. Really good to hear from him. Martin, how are you, sir?
Yep, very good, thanks. Yeah, I thought you might swerve this one after the Matildas got knocked out today. But here you are, stalwart.
Fresh, Martin, come on. All right. Yeah, fair play. But who's gonna take the final?
England, I believe.
So biased. Come on, mate. Spain. Let's go, Spain. Johnny, or Jono and Donnie, we love you guys. It's actually why I came to this podcast. I wasn't going to turn up, but you guys were here. So I thought, well, look, you're some of my favorites. You're coming back to tell us something new, actually. So how are you, Jonathan?
I'm very well. I like the way you've merged us into some kind of God awful hybrid. Johnny, yeah. Which is very good.
Jonathan, yeah. Move to the right of your screen. And I'll move to the right. Side, and then we could kind of merge together and just, you know, we yeah. become one person.
I don't think any sentence, it sounds like trouble, doesn't it, Johnny and Donnie? No sentence sounded good when you say Johnny and Donnie's out there, and you're like, oh, they're up to no good, these two. But you've partnered up with something, so I'm pretty interested to get into this. And I know, Jonathan, you had kind of an intro to this conversation, and that will get us all salivating. And
I was going to start with a story about Storm Desmond in 2015. So I really need Dale to do some storm noises here and sort of sound effects.
Do the storm. Yeah.
But Storm Desmond was a hurricane, in as far as the UK has hurricanes, that hit Cumbria in 2015. And Cumbria is part of the northwest of England. It's commonly called the Lake District. And this storm deposited, I think, something like 34 centimetres of rain in a 48-hour period, and it flooded 19,000 homes. It significantly damaged 72 bridges, and it washed away a 5-kilometre stretch of the A591, which won't mean a lot to you, Val, but basically it meant that local traffic had a 64-kilometre diversion, and HGVs had a 112-kilometre diversion. So it's pretty major stuff. And there's tons on the storm and on the recovery program. So people should go and Google it because it's an amazing program. And basically the county council were faced with this situation that their normal infrastructure budget was something like 10 million. And the repairs were going to cost 10 or 15 times the amount of their normal budget. So they had no capability, no skills of dealing with this at all. But actually what they did and what their partners did was extraordinary, because the first thing they did was, rather than looking at each individual infrastructure repair and costing it, and then they looked at them all together. So they got some very whizzy tech from Mott MacDonald and Geist. So they got some drones and some sonars to look at all these bridges. And that allowed them to come up with an overall figure, which meant they could get a fund from government. I think it was 120 million. They then used an approach to contracting. So they used cost reimbursable contracts, which did imply there was a higher risk on the local authority. But to counter that, National Highways formed a non-partisan group of elected members to provide them with oversight and governance. They used a model of principal contractor and local subcontractors, which meant that 70% of the bridge repairs were carried out by local firms, which created local economic security. There's a sense of ownership. Local people trusted what was happening. You've got local knowledge about the ground conditions. So again, go and have a look at the recovery program, because it's kind of a brilliant way to run a project. It's very intuitive. Everybody knows what's needed. They know how to triage the portfolio of repairs. Everyone collaborates for the greater good. There's local knowledge and there's data at the heart of decision making. And the emergency governance procedures they have meant that decision making was really fast and enabling, whereas on most major projects, it seems to be slow and constraining. So everything about that is kind of what we're talking about in reimagining project management, new PM, this idea of the grand experiment,
which
I think Donnie, we owe to Andy Murray, who coined the phrase. But that's the kind of background to what we're doing, and I'll pass you over to Donnie to expand on some of the elements of the story.
Maybe actually it's, I think the principle and why the story is so fantastic is that people were really adaptable. They had none of the capabilities likely to tackle something like that. But because they had all this, they thought about they were open and honest with each other and themselves. They built relationships really quickly. They didn't go into a protectionist type mindset. So you could lightly go through and say all of those things allowed them to work in a completely different manner from what you might expect. And it's a kind of lovely case study because the stuff we're doing, and I'll expand more on what we mean this term new PM, is trying to almost give every project team that experience of you know, what could you do by providing people with information about themselves, the team, the dynamics of the team, the quality of the relationships, the level of trust, and so on, to almost fast track teams to get close to the way that they were able to act and work. And that's Jonathan's story. And I'll tell you more about UPM. Is anyone else getting an echo, or is it just me?
Yeah, Dale is just sorting out some settings in the background, Donnie.
Okay, yes. All right, cool. Is it worth maybe just saying a little bit more, or maybe actually before we go on? So there's a great story, Jonathan, that sets up nicely what we can achieve. If we go back to Andy Murray's phrase or description that he was using a few months ago, and I cannot remember what the event was. It was a major projects call. It might have been one of the project data analytics ones, possibly.
Yeah.
And he made some throwaway comments, and I thought they were unbelievably fundamental about our project's world. That he said, ultimately, every project is an experiment, and we put, and I'm sure you gents all have heard this and many from other different people, but couched in different ways. So we project management aims to look like it's providing certainty around something that fundamentally isn't really certain. So we create plans, we create structures, we put in place project management offices to then control this thing. We give it a definitive single date. We give it a distinct, a single cost. We give it when in fact it's just a fantasy, given the complexity of even relatively straightforward projects like, you know, Val, you're going on holiday with your family. How much is it going to cost? Don't know. I could spend a couple of days, but I'll likely be a good percentage out anyway because it's too hard. Well, that's just X number of people going on a holiday where you know, and that's difficult. So we live in this parallel universe of putting total certainty, and we put such reliance on the hard mechanistic data around it. And I think we try and control the projects. Like, oh my God, we're slipping by this milestone. We must get it back in the milestone. When in fact, who the hell came up with a milestone in the first place? And if that one's slipping, will it really matter if it does or doesn't? And I'll come on maybe later on in the podcast to talk about AI, because I think there's another interesting link, but I'll try not to complicate it by going off at too many tangents. So if you said, my God, yeah, okay, so maybe projects aren't like that. So then you think, you know what? Actually, if you were building in more of a kind of human-centric data, what were people actually feeling and thinking? Their gut feeling, their perceptions, whatever. And you were giving as much credence to that as you were to the trying to control things with the hard project control PMO-centric data. Would that give you a different level of insight and perspective in the project? Now, we've only mapped our new PM thinking into that quite recently, literally in the last week or two, we've been mapping it to what Andy's doing. But it kind of makes it maybe even easier. And I'm going to use the term sell because it's a commercial thing, but it's a new way of looking at it. Is, you know, you working with meeting quality, what do we mean by human-centric data? Well, if you understood collective perception of success, how compelling people thought the vision was, how well even the meetings were adding value to it, what level of psychological safety was of the team, what level of trust there is between the team, what the quality of the relationships are between the team.
Well, I think we've lost.
I could go on. There's
Donnie there a little bit.
Data.
Jonathan, do you know what he was?
Most people go, God, yeah, that's really important for projects, but it's not captured. And you might run a workshop every 6 months to do something about it, but it's not captured and talked about and considered the same way that you would with, you know, risk variance, number of reds increasing, or cost variation, or milestone predictability, or. And you think, my God, there's another set of data here. We literally would neither think about nor capture nor form of analyze. And the new PM bit, just to finish my little babble, is it's not actually then keep them separate. And Dale, you'll have heard some of this because I know we talked to you about this in more detail. It's actually bring them together. So let's take the metaphor that most people would associate project management and project control with, which is the dashboard. And people think project management, well, I want one of those dashboard things. If you're not a project manager or you're an exec, I want a dashboard thingy that you guys and ladies do. Would the dashboard would be different because it would have a whole, not just another bit of set of data, but it would have a merge of it, you know, where you've got perceptions of success, one axis. I'm making this up, by the way, perceptions of success with versus milestone variation. And we've played, and in fact, actually, that's an amazing, you draw a graph, and what that might have got, I don't even know, it goes up, down, sideways, bar. But you would have a new set of data you'd then have conversations about. You go, my God, it's an early warning. That actually tells us by drawing that, before the milestones start slipping, the team's already, by their individual collective perspective knowledge, they actually saw it coming, but nobody could quite articulate it in the way that typically you want to see it in a project management context. And at that, I'll shut up because I could babble on about this because it's very
passionate.
Loads of material.
I'll pick it up, Donnie, because I was thinking, but I do think this human-centric thing is so important, because if you've got somebody, maybe they're in the supply chain and do they really understand the intent behind the project? Probably not, because they've joined the project at a later stage. Nobody's really bothered to tell them the big picture, to really engage them. The vision is just incomprehensible. Maybe they don't, even if they do begin to understand it, maybe they don't believe it. You know, they're thinking, the reason you brought us on is because you're already 2 months behind, and they just don't believe. And then, of course, there's the constraints that whatever they know and whatever they believe, they can only say certain things, because there's certain things you're not allowed to say. You're not allowed to say that. No, you can't admit that. You can't say that. And so how they can possibly work effectively, how they can really use their brains, how they can offer critical feedback as a critical friend, how they know when they can legitimately, when it's legitimate to see some variance in the plan and maybe to do something different, and what are the constraints and they just, all they've got is, no, you just do this and you do what you're told, and you've got all these amazing people with such skill who can kind of give you feedback on the bits that are working and the bits that aren't working. I mean, if you look at, I come back to Mark Wilde talking about the shortcomings of Crossrail, and the fact that when it all went wrong, you know, a large chunk of the risk was down with the supply chain and was invisible to them, and they just could not see what the problems were 6 months out, and as a result, they were 4 years late, and you sort of think, well, that's presumably because either nobody dared tell you, or nobody understood that's what you needed to know. I mean, it is all about perception and the kind of human dynamic of the project, really.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, there's a lot to unpack in that, those two pieces that you paired really well. You know, you guys are like wine and cheese. It's great. And I think with the way that it was phrased at the start of the story around experiment, I mean, I think
we've used some similar, you know, analogies or anecdotes, Dale, with controlling chaos on projects is kind of what we talk about. And I kind of phrase controls as trying to turn chaos into order, which is this almost a preemptive fabrication of systems and methods that we know probably won't necessarily work. And a lot of them are historically reflective, which means by the time it's happened, we've only just found out and it's too late to change. And one of the challenges we have with that is it's really demoralizing. And so it's hard to motivate a group of people, let alone a whole project, to move forward even when we get losses like that. Because it's a difficult moving engine when projects start. You've kind of got this window of opportunity to set it up right. And once the engine is kicked on, reflective change is such a hard thing to thread back through into a project. And I think what you're talking about is really interesting. And I want to peel back some of the layers between kind of what we do fundamentally and traditionally on projects today, and what are the fundamental differences with this human-centric design that make it appetizing. And if it is an experiment, I mean, it'd be great to experiment a bit more. So my question maybe to you first, Johnny, is around, like, what are the fundamental differences between what you're proposing here and the current kind of way of working? I know you kind of touched on it a little bit, but maybe we can go into a bit more detail.
I think it's this continuous conversation that you're having, which is anonymized, with the people that you're working with. So you're able to, in a sense, check their health as well as the project's health. Again, you know, if I go back to the Crossrail project, I think it was Mark, it may have been one of the other people from Crossrail, when they were talking about delivering the Elizabeth line, they said that, you know, when it all went wrong, everybody was working in their own little department. And I think it was Mark that posited that maybe people were sort of saying, oh, God, well, I'm not sure that my bit's going to deliver, but everybody else seems to be happy. So honestly, actually, I think we can probably just fudge it on my bit, because everybody was feeling like that. And collectively, nobody's bits were working, but they just weren't able to communicate that across the project. So it's really thinking about the role that the individuals and their belief and their sentiment has on the project, because it is fundamental. It will affect the way that they work. It will affect their relationship with others within the project. And Val, you were talking about lagging indicators. This is very much a kind of leading indicator. I mean, I just had a mental picture of that scene in Die Hard. Die Hard 2, when they're all at the airport and suddenly all the airport, all the plane arrivals go from kind of on time to delayed to cancelled. And it's a bit like that with a project. You sort of, everything's green with a bit of orange, and suddenly you've got seven reds appearing and, oh my God. And actually, there's plenty of evidence that this approach allows you to anticipate that, because people start to know, they know that this is getting a bit dodgy, and they know that quite a long time before it actually appears on the rag register. And you know, we should be using that intelligence, really.
Yeah, I think so. And I think we've talked to Martin Paver about this kind of data-led kind of project society in it. And I think he's coming up from a kind of an integrated delivery framework where we have data kind of telling us the objective truth, where sometimes, even when it is integrated, you have subjective truths being layered on top. You have personal intentions and agendas, sometimes called politics, which also kind of plays fiddly with the numbers. Even when you see red suddenly becomes not red. Someone's trying to convince you that's not really red. That's a shade of red. That's really pink. And then there is a really dark red. You know, and so you have a shade of, you know, back to your example, Jonathan, of like a sea of different types of red, and now it's a gradient rather than just one type. So it can get slippery, because people don't like to be publicly shamed. They don't like to be wrong. They don't like to lose, and there's a fundamental human behavior to that, particularly if you're competitive. And unfortunately, I think there is a project culture or environment, at least when I've been in projects, it's very competitive because people's careers are also in this mix of project dilemma, if you like. So project dilemma is also a high pressure environment, but you've also got people trying to develop their skill set, right? And get a raise and provide for their family. So what's your view on that? Maybe Donnie, you first and then Johnny.
Well, if I just go back a little bit, the original question was about what's different. I think today we're only going to try and pick up on one particular bit thing about trying to bring more human-centric view and data into the controls world, because you could sit and talk about other things like the methodology should be written differently to be more human-centric. You name it, there's a whole, leadership should be more of an important thing. Team dynamics, for putting aside data, should be considered more. The makeup of teams should be explicit, blah, blah. So there's a whole series of more human-centric things that everyone agrees with, that doesn't often happen. This bit, I guess, because it picks up on data and AI and human, so it's a little bit, we've kind of boiled it down to, well, give us an example. If I maybe just dive in a little bit of the mechanics of this, Val, and the specifics, so that then if anybody's listening to this, and for what it is about capturing data that's human-centric, i.e., the data is from humans, but it's mainly, you're not asking them to repeat, what do you think the cost of the project is going to be? Is it 1.786 million, 840? It's not anything like that. You're going, what do you think the perception of success is on this project? Give me your perspective on it. How well do you think the team is working dynamically? And Jonathan said, if you're capturing data like that and you tie it then into the governance structure, so every time you have got governance meetings in this project of mentioning we're helping reset in Australia, there's at least three levels of governance and you build it into each of the levels. So at every meeting, you're asking people for this kind of data and that data is shared with everyone openly. So if Val and Dale and Donnie happen to say, I don't think there's a bloody hope in hell, and we do our slider, just one factor down it, perception of success, they won't know it was Val, Dale and Donnie that did it, but three out of the dots that you would see on a graph would be down at 20-30%. Now that, oh my God. Now that's openly shared with everyone. And if you ask for comments, and then from the comments we then get sentiment analysis, I don't want to bore you with the mechanics of it, but if you can imagine you've got it at a steering group level, the delivery, broad delivery, core delivery groups, the team groups below it, and you've got that kind of data openly getting shared, you could argue that it's very hard for a project to go south and not spot it. Back to Mark Wilde's point, it would be because it's all anonymous and you don't actually know. And as long as you've got 10, 12 people in a governance meeting lately, you really are never going to know who's saying, actually, I don't think this is going to be delivered successfully. Mm-hmm. I think the team, I have got major issues about my own productivity and my own well-being. Or all of that's been captured very simply and continuously as part of the governance cycle and shared with everyone. It's that one of the interesting bits we've got at the moment, Val, is nobody's looking for it, because nobody's really thought about capturing it. And even if we did capture it, then it's difficult to know what even you would do with it. Now, the person that's been at the forefront of this is, I think you guys have spoken to Kelvin McGrath, Meeting Quality in Sydney. Now, so we're building this off the back of an amazing product that Kelvin's got. Now, you could likely do it in other ways. Just say it's very smart in the way it does it. But put aside the product and the mechanics of it, it's more the principle of thinking, my God, imagine if we did have anonymous data of how everyone really felt in some level of detail every time they walked out a governance meeting. Oh my God. Mm. Would we be as complacent? And then I've got to do a big shout out. I think you gents know it. I mean, Joe Jolly at the Cabinet Office, we're doing this with Joe on the Transforming Infrastructure Performance Projects. We're applying this and at the steering group level and a couple of other bits around it. We're doing this, you know, and Joe was really brave because she went, right, let's run it. And, you know, Joe will tell you it wasn't necessarily the absolute prettiest picture in the world. And I can say that because Joe said it openly as well. And she said, please share. It wasn't the prettiest picture in the world, what it said. But Joe was like, well, that's why we did it. If I knew everything was absolutely hunky-dory and it was totally out of control, I likely wouldn't have done it. But I knew there was like, could improve here and there. So I starkly started to have data and then started an intervention to see, can we improve it? Can we improve the sense of productivity of the team or the likelihood of success or how compelling they think the vision is or? So I'm just conscious. I think I've likely forgotten your question now, Val.
If I jump in there, so the last time we had you on, we talked a bit around DISC profiles and I suppose my question is, how does that impact some of the human-centric data on projects, and particularly what you were just talking through there? How do we try and avoid some of the optimism, pessimism, all of the other biases that we could talk about for an hour? How do we try and get around those when we are doing that data? I might pass to Jono first.
Well, do you mind? Because I've got too quiet. I've got a very specific response, actually, Martin. Is, and I know you gents can put links in, I think, as part of the podcast just at the end. The Praxis framework, that all that thinking I last time was a kind of quite a key part of the conversation. We've now massively expanded it. So what the DISC profile, and not everyone likes the DISC type, because not type is not necessarily the flavour of the day, but it's used all over the world. So DISC, Adrian Dooley at Praxis has just done a video about the DISC thing, and it only came out a couple of days ago. So I can give you a link. So it's a 2.5 minute video about talking about, hey, isn't it interesting how different people perceive XYZ? So that's the, that I'll share. But to your specific point, Martin, the DISC bit is one of the bits of data that we could capture from people, likely just as a one-off at a steering or a project team meeting. And of course, if you knew that most of the people are in a certain quadrant, there's a bias towards a certain quadrant, and then you start seeing data, and apologies if there's any psychologists listening to this podcast, but if you had the yellows, the eyes, and it doesn't really, if you don't know what it is, I won't try and explain this, but go onto the web and it's easy. You know, if you had the eyes saying that things are going really well, eyes are the optimists, right? They're the people who generally will always be the slightly more optimistic than most. So you go, fair enough. Now, if you get the C's, the conscientious, or the kind of, I guess right, depending on nomenclature, the blues, starting to say, oh my God, things are going really badly or well, you might take more notice of it because you would expect, so they might be crudely more pessimistic than the eyes optimistic. And again, apologies to the psychologists listening to this. I'm only going by running this with thousands of people and hundreds of workshops. It kind of starts from there. So you could build in that this thing to exactly what we are talking about. And it's another bit of data that might help you when you analyze the perceptions and way the team's feeling and the quality of relationship. It's one other additional bit of data that you would feed in to it. Hopefully that's giving you that.
Yeah.
Jonathan?
No, that's good stuff. I think that's absolutely right.
I was just going to say, we don't also want this to be such a boring podcast that we're diving into such technicalities, all this stuff. Because I was even sitting conscious going, if I was listening to this, I'd be going, cricket's getting a wee bit technical, you know, God, specific data sets. So maybe I'm guarding against myself as well. It's, you know, this is, we need to come back to what's this about? Helping projects to improve and giving people more sense, more tools to be able to help deliver projects successfully. And this is just one way of doing it. So sorry, Jonathan.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, if I go back to the original story, the Sean Desmond story, you know, okay, I'm probably exaggerating, but that sense that, you know, people were working together and collaborating together very effectively, and they were able to do that even in the context of a project where organizations and people were thrown together, and it's that you're looking for, really. It's our innate ability to work together and to problem solve and to decision make together. And I think the trouble is that if I let me take an example of governance, and I'll probably get shot down for this, but what one of the downsides of governance is, you know, you create an artificial system for assuring things. So if you think about ethics, let's take the example of British politics, which is really not in a very happy place at the moment. And you replace personal ethical systems with an artificial system, governance. Then people start saying, well, I did nothing wrong because I actually abided by the governance system. So we create these systems as a sort of an artificial alternative to our own human-based systems, because we have to, because we're working together. But if we allow those systems to become too big and to really, really run the thing, and they divorce us from our own internal systems, then the whole thing starts to break down, because we're kind of playing a game rather than collaborating as humans.
Hmm.
Did that make sense, Martin, or was it absolute rubbish?
No, definitely. No, thanks a lot for that. Just one more from me. You kind of piqued my interest on something at the start there, Donny. So when we were talking about, we all know the pitfalls of forecasting and providing data, I was almost thinking, what has been some of the feedback from the Cabinet Office on this? So where we're saying, you know, we're going to spend X amount on a project in this financial year. As a government, you probably do need some of these areas, because it builds into your strategy. You know, you've got to spend X amount on health, X amount defense, X amount infrastructure. You need all this data coming through ultimately, and you need to feed it into your own national strategy. I think they call it leveling up in the UK. What has been the feedback on the data so far, and have they been able to have better quality of data, better decisions based on this? If I go to you, Donny.
I would love to be able to answer that question, Martin, because that would mean that what we're doing with Joe in the IPA has now expanded across the GMPP. And I would love if I could positively answer. I can tell you, not hypothetical, we have talked about, imagine you had this running, let's go into fantasy world. Imagine you had this running across a portfolio, and you were able to get a little bit of the perceptive data from the actual teams. And we were actually just talking about this a week or so ago, of just to balance out the hard data that you get on the project, you get the soft perceptive data about what the project leaders might think. And then you might go another layer below it, you know, and say, well, actually, if you had the view of a project team within, say, a program or within a portfolio, would that give you a, oh my God, it's project says it's going to deliver by X on Y amount of money. I've got another set of data here that says, no, they're not, because not the team don't even believe it, and the team's dynamics are shot to hell, and most people are burnt out, and or whatever. Sorry, I'm always going to take the negative view because it slightly sounds better. It sounds more of a good case study. But if you had that kind of data, you think, my God, now the conversation with IPA is, well, how would you be able to capture that data without having a big intervention on every project and every program and every portfolio? That's where it gets tricky. And that's, I don't want to overstate it, Martin. I wish we were getting into this in real detail. We're talking about it. We're doing it with one set thing about transforming infrastructure program, but we're talking, and actually with other government functions at the moment, about how could you use this kind of thing. But it's a hard, I'm going to use the term sell, is because nobody's, if you don't have it, it's a bit hard, unless it's literally, I don't know, it's like the iPhone, and somebody comes on, somebody puts an iPhone in front of you for the first time, and you literally do go, oh my God. And I remember the first time I saw one with my Nokia, which I thought was the best thing from the world. And then I saw an iPhone, I thought, oh my God, I'm sold, because it was so neatly put together. This thing that we're talking to you about, I'll likely listen back in this podcast. We will likely listen back in this podcast in 12 months or 24 months or 36 months and go, oh my God, we weren't using the term human-centric data. Oh, we were. Oh, because we don't almost know how to frame it and put it into the projects world and to sell the concept, because it's like there aren't hundreds of case studies to show the value of it. And to be back to Kelvin in Sydney, Kelvin's company, you know, has been running and all this stuff. We're just picking it up, using it a slightly different way and expanding its use in the UK. Because of the work Kelvin does, he can't bang on about all the wonderful successes because it's private to the companies he works for. So you can't actually be saying, God, here's a great example of a project that's about to fail, and then we fixed it. Company will go, stop talking about a project that nearly failed. So it's... We're still shaping what this is, but we know fundamentally, thus hopefully you can hear the passion. It's not a tiny little nuanced thing that fits in the corner of the projects world. It's a pretty fundamentally different thing. And I'll come to you again, Dale, because I know we've talked about it. You know, it's a pretty fundamental different way of looking at projects and controlling projects potentially. That's why we're still putting so much effort into it.
It's
a fascinating space. Sorry, go ahead, Johnny.
I was thinking back to the first interview I ever did when I first joined MPA 7 years ago now, and I interviewed Ed Hoffman, who's ex-chief knowledge officer at NASA. And one of the things that he was talking about was this idea. In those days, of course, it was pre-hybrid, so people were working, you know, they were working in the office. And he talked about the sound of success. When you went into NASA and into a project office, you could hear the sound of success. And the sound of success wasn't silence, and it wasn't people shouting at each other. It was that people communicating with each other, people excited, people exchanging ideas. And that's, in essence, what we're looking for, because right. I'm doing some work for the APM at the moment, and I picked a particular project to look at. I was looking at the government's geological disposal facility. So this is the facility to take nuclear waste, relatively low-level nuclear waste, and bury it underground. And I think it's a 40-year program or something like that. And what strikes me about this is there's a lot of engineering involved in that, but there's an awful lot of stuff we just don't know how to do it. Because if it was easy, we wouldn't need 40 years. I don't think we'd need 40 years to do it. We'd just do it. And to my mind, that means we need a totally different approach to projects and to knowledge sharing and to collaboration. Because at least, I don't know what the percentage is, but a large chunk of that project is innovation, is working out how do we take a load of nuclear waste and bury it safely underground. And that's not just an engineering project, that's a social project, because you've got to make sure that the people it's buried near are happy enough to have it buried near them. And then you've got to have, you know, safety for the people who are, for the actual construction. And then you've got to have systems that passive systems that will keep this stuff safe for millennia. So we honestly don't know how to do it. But I look at a project like that, and maybe I haven't looked at it closely enough, or maybe I'm just I'm not, just not shown that. But there's nowhere is that process for kind of collaborating and learning and innovating and talking about how are we going to do this stuff. It's just a project. We just kind of, we know how to do a project, so we do it as a project. And I think this human-centric approach is, again, back to the Storm Desmond. It's people working together, talking together, say, yeah, we need to do it like this. Yeah, great, okay. And they're able to work it out between themselves, and they're motivated to work it out between themselves. They're not told, well, hang on, we haven't got time to talk about that because we're trying to deliver this thing. Actually, part of delivering this thing is talking about that and articulating that, getting a sense of people's belief or the credibility of the solutions that you're coming up with, their ability to deliver, the deliverability of the project. All of these things are down to the project team. And of course, you've got your hard data alongside that. So you can't suddenly get into a big group think and float off into fantasy land, because you have got your hard data that's saying, oh, we seem to be 200% overspend at the moment. So together, I think, you know, and you know, we don't pretend to know how exactly how you relate this hard and this soft data. And I think that would, in any event, that would be project specific and specific to the context of the project. But we're just saying that actually,
don't say that, Jonathan. We're total and utter experts, and we'll work it all out.
If you've got the hard data and the soft data, and you can see trends and you can see patterns, then you know you've got something to talk about. And I think it's probably because I come from a liberal arts background rather than an engineering background. But I find it much easier to talk about people's belief in the project than in understanding some of the implications of some of the project controls. You know, okay, so it says this, what do we do about that? I don't know, you know. But if we know that people doubt the deliverability of the project, we can start to do something about that, because we can ask them, we can explore, we can bring in people to help advise us, the right kind of people. And it just, again, it's a much more kind of human approach. We seem to have lost sight of the human element. And I absolutely don't think that AI will replace that. I think AI is a really useful tool, but I still think you'll need the human element to kind of interpret AI and decide what do you want to do. You know, this is what the data is telling you. What do you want to do, and how are you going to do it?
It's a hugely fascinating topic, I think, and if I kind of sum it up from my perspective, I think what we're talking about is capturing emotion and sentiment towards certain elements during project delivery and taking into account the circumstance and context upon which that sentiment, that emotion is felt, and then how we make decisions during those specific periods, I guess, perhaps under duress, perhaps not. And I agree with you, Jono, it is a really big ask on how we might. I mean, if we find a way to capture the data, that's one thing. That's great. We've got the data now. How do we then go and use it? And is this perhaps where AI comes in and tries to find the correlation, tries to find potentially causation, tries to predict potentially how decisions would be made based on certain circumstances? And then I also asked myself, listening in, it's so fascinating how cultural differences are at play here as well. You know, living in and around London, it's a melting pot. And so where one person might come across as pessimistic, actually they might not be. That might just be the way they speak and the way they talk. So how accurately can you then capture emotion if you can't take into account their cultural heritage and background? The personality types are great because there's a certain way, whether you agree with them or not, there's a way to capture, as you say, Donnie, the DISC profiles. But I just wonder if, and to borrow from Eddie Obeng, I know you both know and love Eddie, are we potentially finding a solution to a problem that doesn't already exist? Or actually, is there something here that we do definitely have a problem with, and this is a solution that no one has really thought about looking at in detail? John, let's go with you first.
Well, I mean, I'm glad that you've mentioned Eddie, and I think that, you know, several of his project types, and particularly the foggy project, the kind of project where you're walking in fog, you don't quite know where you're going and you don't know how to get there. You just need to know that you need to get there. I mean, the example is, you know, climate change, addressing climate change. And you know, Eddie's argument and Eddie's approach to that is a very human-centric one, that you know, we move forward and collectively, each with our hands out in the fog, and then we report back as to what we're feeling, what we're sensing. So I think it's a reality. I just don't think we necessarily recognize the complexity of what we do. It's weird. I mean, there's something strange about projects and the way we treat projects, that you know, when we take on a project, you know, we've gone through the process of risk identification and mitigation of risk. So we've kind of tried to make the project as safe as possible. So it's quite hard, and it's hard within government to say, you know, this project over here, that's really risky. You know, we think we need to do it, but it's very experimental. We're back to the idea of the grand experiment, and it's really risky. And we just don't kind of admit that. We treat it as if it's big and it's difficult and it's complicated, but it's not necessarily complex and it's not necessarily risky. So we can do it. We can do it. And I think that does us a kind of disservice. You know, I've been thinking about, you know, what are the big things, and I was thinking about the five big things that we need to get better at, or we need to change in the way that we see projects, and you know, seeing projects as experiments, big projects as experiments is one, and the whole question of failure, I think we need to get to grips with that. You know, what is a failure? The idea of experimentation is the experiment may not lead to the outcome that you anticipate, but you learn a huge amount from that experiment. So it's not a failure. But equally, you know, we know that projects, particularly innovative projects, are potentially going to end up as failures, or are going to end up as being stopped. And we need to change the sense that it's a failure, because you know, everybody working on the project, and particularly the SORO or the project sponsor, they don't want to work on a project that's going to be deemed a failure, because everyone will look at them as, hey, your last project was a failure. We don't want to work with you. So, again, we talked about reframing projects as grand experiments. Maybe we need to reframe the ideas of project success or project failure as well.
And back to your original question, Val, about how do you make it more human-centric, there's another couple of things that Jonathan has just brought up about how you make it more projects human-centric. I mean, it's such a complex system, this projects world, as I'm sure you gents know from all your interviews, that you can't look at one bit of it and not look at all the rest at the same time. And that's what makes it so confusing. And we're now very consciously bringing something else into the mix there's always been the people side, because we've written books in it and all that. Now it's like, oh my God, we're bringing the people side and data, and I haven't even touched on the AI bit much yet, into the same thing. And it is a bit of, God, how do we use that? How do we apply that into this projects world? But I think whoever made the point about actually using AI, the approach of using the new PM thing is to do trends, is to capture data, is to see stuff moving. But the I think you described it, Dale, as, you know, how do you do the interpretation? Whatever. At the moment, that's done by an idiot like me. And I sit and I look at the from 1 week to the next, whatever. But if you were doing it for just fantasize here for a whole portfolio, a human would, and trust me, you don't need many data sets with adding in where somebody is based and their disk profile and whether they work at home, whatever. And then all of a sudden, 8 sets of data already, add in all those facts, a human's overwhelmed almost by the how you spot trend. But you think, God, if you're applying that across projects and portfolios, you would need to say, what do you see? What do you predict? Is this cause for concern? And the fact, and we try to use the term enhanced decision making. It's not a silver bullet, that's for sure. But it would just enhance. So you think, if you had that new kind of data, would, if you built up a bit of a data set, would you be able to go, this is of concern or it's not of concern? It does fit within a reasonable funnel. You know, it is all right at this stage of a project to have this type of sentiment for this type of project, for this level of maturity of organization in this industry, you know? So, and I guess that's almost the kind of end plan type world where they've got their, what is it now, you know, 750 or 800,000 schedules now, where they can go pharmaceutical, build a new factory, and they're likely have got 1,000, you know, 2,500 schedules of putting a new facility up, and they've got that trend data. So we were talking about it last week, ourselves, Jonathan, and another chap, Stuart Harrison, we work with, and going, God, let's fantasize. Now imagine you did have that trend data, and you go, you know what? Actually, the team feeling burned out at this stage with this level of perception of success is kind of all right, married to this hard data. That we've seen it before, it usually ends up all right. So here's a few things we'd recommend. That's the fantasy position with what we're talking about.
Yeah, it's great.
And if someone's listening to this and going, okay, I want to test this out around my project team or ask a few questions, you know, with the folks I work with and collect some of that data, what are some of the categories that they'd have to calibrate for? Because you're doing this at the moment, Donnie. How do you use any categories to calibrate to say, actually, I do know the disk profile, or I do know the role that the person is in? Are there any categories you use to calibrate, or is it purely just based on the response you get back?
If you ask me the question in 3 or 6 months' time, One of the tasks we've got, and I think I've got what you're asking, Dale, is so I'm going to sound like I'm going completely left field, but I'm not, is trying to find a single model that says what's a standard model for project controls data or project reporting data set. Likely isn't quite as easy to get a hold of. But by the way, if either of you three gents have got a really robust one, I'd love a copy of it if there's no breaking it. So if you've got that set of data, imagine down one side, the human-centric data you can kind of make up at the moment. Yeah? So you could have stuff, and I'm going to my website just to cheat here, just as a reminder of the kind of stuff. If you started capturing the disk profile of the team, the perception of success, whether they were male or female, whether they work from home or whether if they, what else, the level of psychological safety. So, you know, imagine, for example, if you were capturing the level of psychological safety and you were in an insurance world, my God, that would be gold dust, you know. Level of psychological safety in the team, 32%. Oh my God, I can't trust anything that I see in my traditional dashboard. Biases, actually, Kelvin and ourselves, we were actually working out what, you know, there's a kind of big 5 biases that most people associate in the projects world. If you had some means of measuring that, and asking teams maybe through 360 around it, or the relationship, quality of relationship, who do I get on with within the team, who do I think is adding value, blah, blah. I've given a very long, babbly answer, Dale, to there's likely an infinite number of data sets that you could potentially use. The clever bit that we're trying to do, and I'm happy to talk to anyone about this, is to try and choose what's the absolute minimum set of data that you should be capturing, given your context and what you think the problem is. Otherwise, you could have somebody going, well, for every meeting, we need 18 minutes at the end of the meeting to capture this data. It ain't going to happen. You've got, like, first survey, you've likely got push it with people 3 or 4 minutes, and you go, please, first one, it's the, we're going to ask you for your disc or maybe a quick assessment and whatever. Beyond that, you're like 1-2 minutes. And you've got to accept the fact you're not going to know everything, but you're trying to choose what are the core thing. And the reason I mentioned about that PMO-centric was this is the, we've just started the process of mapping what might be the human-centric data sets to what the PMO control and reporting data sets are. Do you know what? I'm going to sound like I am laughing. If I listened to myself 3 years ago, now I would be sitting here going, what the hell is he talking about? Because if anybody who knows me, maybe Jonathan, you know, I mean, I was not the guy that's on the chatter today. It's only because of the Martin Paver introduction into project data analytics, into the project data analytics task force, the Kelvin, the data, that's completely and utterly opened my eyes. You know, I'm listening to this, and please, if you are listening to this, you're going, oh, he's some tech head. Trust me, I'm not. I'm a human-centric leadership guy who does consultancy around big projects. This stuff is potentially gold dust. Joe Jolly thinks it's gold dust already in the IPA, but we'd love for it to be gold dust. The thinking, whether it's with us or whoever, doesn't matter. With people having this stuff as the norm and making use of it, that would excite the hell out of us.
Yeah, it does. I mean, it does require an adult approach to projects and project management. You know, you can't gamify if you've got this. But if you have got an adult approach, I think the opportunities for this data, I mean, it gives you much greater confidence if you're working on something that's more risky or more complex. You know, if you've got really good data that you can show to your investors to say, look, actually, our perception of predictability, our perception of success is very good. The team believe that we will deliver. I mean, that's really important to investors, that they get a sense that actually not only is there a good plan on paper, but the team genuinely believes in what they're doing and they're motivated and they will deliver.
Okay. Can we just give one other another example? Is we were, and I don't think it was in this. I don't think it was with you, gents, because this is all. It's been a couple of years, I think, since I did the last one. If you use the same philosophy we've just been talking about, if you were the head of assurance for an organization and you wanted to assess your projects, if you had something like level of, can you show me? You're about to go into a project. Say, could you show me your data from the last 3 months for your team about level of trust, the level of cognitive diversity, the level of psychological safety, whatever it is, can you show me that data? Because I'm going to look at that first. Then I'm going to look at your dashboards and the hard data you send me. Because if this is anonymized, it's trustworthy, it's been tested at multiple levels in the project, I want to see that and then go, my God, that is going to give me a completely different perspective when I go and carry out the assurance. But of course, then you add in, as Jonathan said, well, actually, the team don't think it can succeed and they don't think the vision was compelling to begin with and. My God, how many people would be brave enough to put that forward data forward at the same time as their what is it, slightly rose-tinted version of the dashboard and the future projections.
Yeah, there's a lot to swallow. And Donnie, you do sound like a tech head, so I do apologize on behalf of everybody listening.
I'm going to go and tell my wife now if she's still awake. She'll be so excited. You're married to a tech head.
It's good. I guess
Jonathan, you think that as well. We're both tech heads. How exciting!
Well, because I think there is a reason why I think you're a tech head, and I'll get to that in a second. But I think as well, the benefit or the use case here is and you mentioned Mark Wilde and a few others as well that I've listened to on mega projects is that, you know, we make poor decisions and poor decisions lead to problems on projects and they compound each other. And they're conflated together because they all go to the leadership pyramid, right? Bad problems go to the top. And then without the data to inform leaders, they make bad decisions and more, and it escalates from there. And so I guess what you're saying is there must be an experiment where we can focus more on the human data set. It's almost like a qualitative data set that can inform us a little bit more, just a bit. Maybe it's an inch, maybe it's a mile, who knows? But there should be some way of measuring the correlation once we run this experiment a few times, I suppose, right? Where we add this data into some projects and stuff and see what comes out the other end. Is that the next big experiment, is to kind of get this onto some projects and give it a really good go in different environments and scenarios? I guess that's more of a leaving comment, but yeah, quick, Donnie, over to you.
I think, yes, it is. And there's likely a couple of stages to it, Val, in that we were talking about, think about it, and I don't want to be talking about the service this is around this. Think of it generically. You want to go in and test it. It's like a health check. Just capture a little bit of data. Does it tell you anything or does it not? Then the next level is simply capturing the qualitative or human-centric data and seeing if that throws up anything. As I say, back to Joe and the IP, it threw up a huge amount because it opened up conversations they'd never had. So that was great, just getting that. The pure new PM bit, the third bit, the exciting bit, Val, was back to the collapsing it together with a hard. And I know, Dale, we touched on this months ago, talking about it, going, you know, what would a dashboard look like if you added, and back to your question earlier, Mark, if you added in people's disk profiles and the diversity of thinking, cognitive, and what the hell would a dashboard look like? What would you'd need to retrain sponsors and assurance professionals and risk professionals. So there's a continuum there. Initially, it's just get some data, some qualitative humans, see if it tells you anything, do it more extensively over longer periods, but ultimately it's out of, you know, and that's why we're evangelizing maybe 10 years from now or 5 years from now, people will go, sorry, you're not capturing that data. What the hell is your dashboard? God, you don't have any human-centric data. And your dashboard, this is old-fashioned. Now, I'm making a wee bit of a jump, gentlemen, but that's, you know, that's where we think it should take it. And it ties up with other stuff. This is not just about the short term now. This is back to writing the project leadership book, Jonathan. It's the same stuff. We wrote it with Sarah. All that human stuff we talked about, there's just a new avenue to bring it out now, and it's called data. And it's the one that's the super sexy everyone's interested in. So if we've gone, let's not fight it, let's go with the flow, which is let's think how human-centric data can now make the big change of bringing more of the human-centric way of thinking in to projects.
I mean, it does come with a health check, which is the commitment to do something, the commitment to intervene, because the first thing that we do with this data is we kind of show you some of the shadow organization behind the real organization, and we show you what's going on. And what we ask from you in return is to respond to that and to undertake whatever the intervention is. You know, where there's a problem, you need to intervene, because there's nothing more caustic than everybody seeing, you know, 20% of the team believe in the project. And if you do nothing about that, that's going to become normalized, and it's going to be, well, it doesn't seem to matter that only 20% of the team believe in the project. the people running the project are taking no notice of that. Therefore, and things will actually get worse. So there's a kind of caveat that, you know, we're gonna kind of show you the underbelly of your project, and you're going to need to, you might need to have a strong stomach, but you're also going to need to commit to actually doing something about that. So once we start to show you this hidden world that you haven't been aware of, or maybe you have been aware of, but you've been able to ignore it. Once we start to show you that, you really have to respond to that, because everybody knows that you've seen it now. You can't pretend that you haven't seen it. So you have to respond. And of course, that doesn't mean that you have to be right in your response. Again, you can experiment with different things. You can see how you can intervene to improve the sense of psychological safety, or to improve the sustainability of the way that the people are working, or their belief in the vision, or whatever it is. But you know, you do have to do something. You can't just say, oh dear, and ignore it.
Yeah, 100%. And I think we probably need a part two in terms of maybe taking a real use case and running it through a scenario and having some different dynamics. It does remind me of some things that Dale and I and Martin had done, you know, a while back, actually, where we mapped out an entire disk profile for, was it 50 or 100 people, something like that. And the interesting thing about understanding people is how they interact. And 90% of the challenges we have is the translation of communication on projects. So what's an urgency for one person is a nice day for another, and how we get to escalate the right things and not the wrong things, and more of this and less of that, you know, the kind of the Snowden approach. And I think with AI now, and I'm just going to slip that in there because we've been threatening to talk about it, but no, we haven't actually really done it yet, is we can now consume large bits of information cohesively, I guess, with context from a machine's perspective. So it's meant to be more objective, but we can now start feeding it humanistic properties, right? As in attributes, because we know how we behave. We've been studying ourselves for some time now. And what's interesting is what happens to people on projects, because there's a rule in kind of NLP and a few other areas that people are not their behaviors. I don't know if you've ever heard that before. Yeah. And it's a projection, and it changes from profile to profile, environment to environment. So, you know, Jonathan could be a very lovely guy on a podcast, but get him in a project and he's ruthless, you know. So there's an interesting concept that changes people's dynamics once they form together. And in fact, maybe you get a few Jonathans and Donnies together, and that's a really dangerous idea, because that's how you have really big house parties and the police show up and, you know, it gets on the paper. And so I think we need to think about how that will factor into it. But you did mention AI before. So who wants to take the chair and tell us how AI plays into this new PM world?
Well, can I just take a specific example you just used with DISC there, Val, which is, and I've spoken with Kelvin about this, is if you had large numbers of team profiles, you would then, or individual team pro, you could then say that the model, by the way, sorry, here we go. You know the team praxis thing I was mentioning earlier? ChatGPT, and I haven't done it with 4, which I've now got, and rather than the 3 point whatever I was using before, you can ask it to rewrite reports based on different profiles, and it'll change the order and the importance in the language and all that. That's a given. That it, I know that it does it because it's done it for me. I've seen it.
Yep.
So you connect. So you then say, well, if you start putting project teams in, you could start saying, given that you know what the profiles of these people are, should this be of a concern or not, the hard report that we are getting coming out? Because is that what you might expect at this stage in a project, back to that data set, Val, if you had it? I mean, a fantasy for me is, you know, you think about the, you know, the NPLANS data set. Imagine you had the equivalent of the human-centric data for all those 750,000 schedules, and you knew who produced them, what the team dynamics were, the diversity of the team that created it. I mean, you then get, whoa. And adds a completely different dimension to, you know, if you get a team who is all biased to in a certain way, the big five biases are all off the scale one way, and they've got a low level of they've got a high level of psychological safety, and they've got a low level of collaboration, and they've got blah, 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 gives you a completely different feel for the way the project might work. You could make use human-centric view to try and do it, but likely AI might be able to give you a bloody good view as to, is this concern or not? We're starting to slip real slippage on hard milestones. Is this or is this not a concern?
Yeah. I mean, it might be interesting to mention, Donny, what Kelvin showed us, how he was using Bard in relation to some of the meeting quality output.
So he was using?
I think he was using Bard with some of the meeting quality output.
So he's getting,
But carry on.
I'll go for it, Jonathan.
No, so Kelvin, being Kelvin, I mean, he loves experimenting and things, and he was taking data from his data sets and feeding it into AI. And I think he was using Bard rather than ChatGPT.
Yeah.
And it would then produce a report on what it thinks you should do on the basis of the data sets and the results that it's seeing. And I think that's fantastic, because AI then, it shortcuts the whole process, because it gives you lots of ideas and options, down to you to use your intuition, your understanding of the organization, your sense of the problem to actually interpret what AI is telling you. You don't just pick it up and say, right, okay, we're going to start with point number one. But the fantastic thing about AI is it does all of this in a fraction of a second, and it gives you everything. You think, oh, yeah, I hadn't thought of that. Oh, that's a great idea. And it just kind of shortcuts the process. You then translate that into the context of your project, and you maybe add one or two other things in. But it's a really great catalyst for what you might do in terms of intervening in response to the kind of data sets that you're seeing.
Yeah, see, I mean, I use chat every day, and I think Dale does too. And, you know, for a lot of the people who haven't, I mean, the first thing is to play, right? If you want to be, I guess there's a relevance important question, not to say that you're going to be redundant, but I think the relevance is that you need to be educated in data, and you need to understand how these prompts and these large language models work. I see two applications that are really interesting. One of them I see from what you're saying today is this almost like this this AI that's able to read the room, yeah, can take all this information in and conflate it together and come up with some insights that you might not have thought about, or you probably had an idea about but you weren't quite sure, and this gives you some validation or confirmation that this is what's actually happening on the ground. I see that's a really good thing, because it's subjective. So objective, it's going to provide you some evidence to leadership, because sometimes if you're just one person with a good idea, we all know what happens in a project, right? It gets squashed, or it's not important, or it's not urgent, or it's not escalated. But this could be the groundswell that you need to put a compelling case forward to say, listen, we've got people who are just not happy on this project, or are not motivated. Motivation leads to less productivity, that leads to errors, you know, whatever it is. I guess the other trick and application is this project personal assistant, which I think we've all been kind of using ad hocly, is this ability to kind of ask somebody else, where that somebody is not a person, it's a machine. And you have access to this huge database of information, and you can prompt and train it to get down to a really, really refined output without having to kind of bother anyone else. And I think that gives a lot of independence to people who have the imagination, the curiosity to ask in the first place, but also to retrieve that information and then articulate their own thoughts back to other human beings. How far are we from this? You say fantasy, Donny. I mean, how far is this stuff away? Are we talking a couple of weeks? Are we talking years? Are we talking decades? It feels like it's moving really fast, but I would love to kind of put that into perspective, into a timeline, because, you know, we are in projects. When will we see AI kind of generative AI being used on projects in this application or in this style? Is it in our lifetime?
Let's take the I would say we could be doing it now. If I took the next couple of days and I was on a call with Kelvin and we sat and worked it out, we could likely get something running. In fact, Kelvin likely argue, because he's forever developed, you go, I've got something that does this. But so just an aside, the doing things like sentiment analysis already exists, of course.
Yeah.
You know, so you're using AI. It used to be IBM's Watson engine we were using. Now, of course, you don't need to have anything clever like that. You just need to go to ChatGPT or Bard or one of the other. And you say, actually, here's some comments that have been provided by the team. What's the underlying sentiment in that? Humans read it. Sentiment plus disk plus, you know, back to all those data set. You think you could be asked, it wouldn't take, I don't think, dreadfully long to give an AI model enough, given its LLM outside of itself, but just applying it to this particular project-centric situation to go, tell us what your perception is, what you think it is. Can you spot a trend? And, you know, take it much further. You say, you know, what do you, to Jonathan's point, what do you think you should do next? And I'm going to go again completely left field. Speaking to a mate today I'm working with, his goddaughter, something to do with a car dealership, and blah, blah. I won't bore you with all things. And it was like, so we started playing today with ChatGPT about write a business case for expanding a certain type of car dealership in the next 3 years within this boundary, blah, blah, blah. It actually came up with specifics. Could we give it enough specifics? It was coming out with specifics about what that car dealership should do next. Sorry, that's conscious really left field, but it was literally a few hours ago doing that. It was spooky. So I don't think it's very long. Back to those data sets again, Val. If, and I do ask of you, gents, if you do know the best generic data set that exists for project performance data and reporting data, if it's existing open source, that plus what we'd be able to pull together, you could start doing some mapping and you could start making some relationships. I think a human would need to help to begin with to go, if a project's perception of success is dropping steeply, this is what it likely means for what might happen next with milestones. Or if you leave it long enough for it to say, go, oh my God, the milestone deliverability start drops through the roof, but a lag of 3 months behind the perceptions and emotions of the people and how they felt in the project. So I think you could get it to generate thinking in AI prompts, but once you've got the data to map that together, then you truly are going, here is the hard and the soft data. What do you think we should do next? And then tell us what the intervention should be.
Yeah.
I think we should get you guys together with Alan Mosca. I think Alan would be up for this. He's got the data from Nplan and perhaps, you know, the hard and the soft data. One of the things, John, if I come back to you, that kind of we've discussed this on previous episodes with AI, and you know the doomsday scenario, the you know the whole Matrix scenario, we're all plugged into machines and they're sucking the life out of us. If we start plugging into AI, machine learning, human sentiment, and how we're feeling, is there a potential scenario where actually, you know what? It's actually starting to control our decision making and what we do. If the creators of ChatGPT doesn't know how it does things sometimes, then how are we as ordinary human beings, mere mortals, to understand if the suggestions and recommendations it's giving us on decisions to make based on human emotion we're feeding it are the correct ones or not? I mean, I don't know if you've watched Black Mirror, the Black Mirror series. There's one episode where you get social credits for, you know, doing good things. Could we ever see a scenario like that happening?
There's
somebody we presented about what we've been talking about to somebody within the nuclear world. I won't bore you with going into more detail than that. It was in the assurance and risk world in the nuclear. And there was somebody in the call and he said, oh, we're already doing this. We've got this. And it was a few months ago, you know, about Teams. Well, now automatically transcribe and do sentiment analysis and. And you say, well, that's the same thing. Trust me, it's not. It's nowhere near the same thing. I'm not saying it's better or worse. It's just it's something different. But when you look at it, that gets scary. Now, I know, speaking with Kelvin, it was like, for most people, that scares the living daylights out of them. So it is going to be listening and transcribing and doing sentiment analysis and comparing across whatever. And it's doing it without even, it just in the background, I'm not even aware of it. And you can do it in a way, I think, that you can have it in the background and blah, blah, blah. Everything we're talking about is completely upfront and completely open to offset it. But it's scary to think, you know, we have been assessing Val's performance over the last X number of meetings, and there's a report gone up, his energy level seems to be dropping. You know, I would think about dropping his bonus by 12%. You know, that's where it really starts to get freaky.
I mean, I think the first part of what you were expressing, Dale, is certainly true, that our behaviour will change in response to this thing. I think the second part is, you know, we do need to get to grips with principles, and actually there's some good government principles come out recently about the use of AI. We need to agree some fundamental principles about how we use AI, and part of that is that we don't take it as anything other than interesting data. You know, we have to apply human judgment to the data. And that has to be written in as a principle so that people don't find that they're, you know, you're saying this, but the AI is saying this, therefore I'm just going to ignore you. But as Donnie says, I think the whole approach that is embedded in what we're doing is that this is a consensual activity. It's a co-creative activity. So people share their data anonymously, but they're involved in the discussion about, well, what do you think this means? You know, this isn't one of the interesting things is, you know, when you produce a report, when Donnie produces a report, everybody sees that report. So it doesn't go to one person who's the supervisor or the manager who can then beat people up. Everybody sees the same report and everybody has an opportunity to contribute to the solutions associated with that report. And of course, if they don't, then it's likely that your data will be revealed in your later data, because how credible do you think this process is? We don't believe in this process because it's not transparent. We don't trust what you're doing. I mean, that's going to emerge the next time you ask them the question.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's, you know, even on emotion, there's probably hindsight as well. When things do go wrong, you probably go, I recognize actually the team aren't worth actually feeling like this in hindsight. So what we're talking about is trying to get some foresight into the emotion going forward. Yeah. But gentlemen, I think, you know, we could probably talk to you for hours and hours and hours, what it's probably been an hour and a half already. And we definitely have to get you back for a part two on this specific topic. I think, you know, for the three of us, myself, Al, and Martin, at least, you've really piqued our interest in this topic, and I'm sure a lot of listeners will also get the juices flowing on, you know, in terms of how they think about how human centric data could play a part in their projects. And so thank you for bringing this discussion to the podcast. Yeah, and I mean, as we head towards the end, though, you know, is there anything that you particularly want to share or finish off with before we head to the end of the pod? I'll start with you, Jono.
Do you want to go to Donnie first? Give me a chance to reflect.
Sure, go ahead. Go ahead, Donnie.
Forget about the AI, forget about the data, and just go back to the underlying principles of what we're talking about. Be more human in your projects. Let the team, you know, find a way for the true open conversations to happen. Keep be cognizant of people's emotions. Think about the diversity in your team. We could go on. All of that stuff, as I said earlier, it's only now because we've got data and we've got AI and all that. We've found a way of doing it, not as a workshop every 6 months. It's like, oh my God, we can do this because the technology's constantly and get new insights. But let's get back to the real foundation. It's humans doing human stuff. This other stuff we've been talking about is just icing in the cake with data and trends and AI. You know, in fact, if you were doing all the good human-centric stuff that you should be doing, you likely don't need to listen to any of that stuff we've been talking about if you actually are applying all the good principles of human-centric working. You likely don't need any of this because your project is completely open and there's fantastic teamwork, or you stop the project because you know it won't deliver, it's human, be human-centric, and all the stuff that everyone is well aware of nowadays, but not many people practice.
Yeah,
well put, well put. I was just thinking back, the ancient Egyptians, I wonder how they felt when they were building the pyramids, but we won't know. Jono, have you had a chance to think about your final thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I find it interesting that, I mean, how quickly this has kind of coalesced in my mind. I mean, I guess it's something that's come together over the last 2 or 3 years, and every conversation has taken me nearer to it. I think it will accelerate, and I think the pressure to do something different and to reframe projects entirely, coming back to this idea of the grand experiment or however we want to frame it, will grow because I don't see how we can deliver what we want to deliver on the basis of what we're doing at the moment. You know, we need a 200% acceleration of everything that we're doing, and we're not going to get that by fiddling around. We're going to get that by saying, well, who have we got working on the project? How do we really get them to work again? You know, I exaggerate the effect, but again, to go back to the Storm Desmond example, you've got a team working together where everybody is motivated, people are communicating with each other, people know what the intent is, and they're able to deliver a great piece of work. I mean, I think it's no coincidence that when I regularly look at Dilbert cartoons and I think, oh God, yeah, that's the way of projects, and it's sad, but you know, he's able to describe projects with a little four cartoon of four pictures, and you think, yeah, that's absolutely it. This kind of Kafkaesque world that people have to navigate, and there's no way you're going to get them to do things faster, better, with greater innovation, unless we do something significant in terms of how we frame this whole world of major project.
Dale, if I might, just to add one little bit to maybe take it back to the most important issue lately of all, which is, look at all the costs going up at the moment. And I was sitting listening to good old Radio 4 again, talking about the costs going up, wages going up, X percentages, productivity in the last 12 months up, they've said it's going up by 1%, some wages going up 8%. Now, I don't know where the stats, it kind of feels about right. We, as Jo Jolly would say if she was on the thing, the planet is burning. We need to be able to find ways to be able to spend tens of billions, hundreds of billions to do things in completely different ways to achieve things that's hard to imagine at the moment, when we find it bloody hard to deliver, you know, a railway line that was able, you know, or whatever it may be. And so actually, this stuff is absolutely critical. We must find ways to improve productivity, not for the sake of just the economy, but for the sake of the fact we need to be able to achieve more as a nation and as a species with whatever assets we have. And if this plays a tiny little fraction of improving it, then great.
Yeah, absolutely. Couldn't have put it any better. Marginal gains all are compounding. Val, can you top that? Any final thoughts from you?
Yeah, I think we should skip ChatGPT and go straight for something implanted in our minds. I think that's just way more efficient. And Jono, Donnie, if you want to be volunteers, I'll definitely put in a word with Elon. But look, I think the other thing around tech heads, you know, you guys are testaments as seasoned professionals that anyone can pick up this data motion and movement and do something with it. And I think that's the takeaway for me today, is that if you guys are on board, then I'm on board, then it must be a good thing. And I think there's a lot for people to explore. And I think it's going to shape new roles as well. I think there's a bright new world in terms of what you can do with all this stuff. And I think we're just tipping the iceberg in terms of capability and potentiality on projects. Thanks for your time, gents.
No, thank you. Thank you for the opportunity again. Yeah,
it's been an absolute privilege and pleasure to have you back. As we said, we got to get you back for part two of this topic as well, because once we've tested it out and the experiment results are in, I think we can have some fascinating chats around, you know, the actual data. But there you have it, folks. This is the end of this episode. But before you go, please do help us pay it forward and share a link to this episode on your favorite social media. Once again, a massive thank you to our guests today, Donnie McNichol and Jonathan Norman. And thank you all for listening. Till next time, we say stay safe, be disruptive, and have fun doing it. From me, Val, and Martin, it's bye for now.
Project Chatter supports and is a member of Zero Construct. Zero Construct is a new working group that wants to lower carbon construction. Not everyone will be aware, but construction contributes to around 12 to 15% of total carbon emissions.
This is a staggering amount, and we need to reduce it. We are a growing community of people that want to help make this change. Everyone is welcome, whether you're an engineer, contractor, or consultant. You just need to want to make a difference.
Our aim is to grow a network of experts so we can all learn from each other and make a positive impact in the places where we work. We'll do this by sharing knowledge and making it accessible in engaging ways.
To join us and find out more, please visit zeroconstruct.com and register as a member. Thank you, and we look forward to speaking with you soon.
For more information, blogs, or to support our charities, visit projectchatterpodcast.com. And if you would like to sponsor the podcast, get in touch via our website.
You can also leave us a voice message via our anchor page and let us know if there's something or someone specific that you would like on the podcast.
The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in this podcast belong solely to the participating individuals and not necessarily to the individual's employer, organization, committee, or other group or individual. Additionally, any views or opinions are not intended to malign any religion, ethnic group, club, organization, company, or individual.